So, Will Eisner wrote some of the first graphic novels ever published. But it was Dennis Kitchen who published them. Back in the 60s, Kitchen was a long-haired hippie artist who was forced to self-publish his comics. So he founded his own company, called it Kitchen Sink Press. Over the next several decades, Kitchen brought hundreds of comics, books, and other novelty items to a growing American audience and helped shape an entire industry. Now, some of Kitchen's early illustrations have been published in a volume called The Oddly Compelling Art of Dennis Kitchen. And Strange Chimp sat down with him recently to talk about his drawings and many of the other works of art and music that he helped create.
Dennis, what's the music we're listening to?
That was R. Crumb and his Keep on Truckin' Orchestra, River Blues, the last 78 RPM recorded that I'm aware of, that we did as a bit of an in-joke because Robert collects old 78s and I collect old 78 RPM jukeboxes. So in the kind of anti-marketing campaign only crazy hippies could do, we decided to record it in an obsolete format.
So I want to go back to kind of the beginning of your life with comics. I think anybody who has had a life at comics surely began as a kid. What were comic books like then? What did you like reading?
I'm glad I had eclectic tastes. I liked the funny stuff like Little Lulu and Uncle Scrooge, but I liked Batman, Superman, and it was hard to avoid the horror comics and the crime comics. They were a little scary when you're little. But I swapped with kids in the neighborhood, mostly other young boys, and they thought only sissies liked the funny stuff. So I used to be able to get two or three for one when I'd swap a Superman and get three Little Lulus. I still think that was a good training on my part. It was also important to me to see that the medium itself had great potential and it wasn't limited to just superheroes.
Well, most kids of your generation kind of outgrew their interest in comics, but comics really stayed with you and kind of grew up right along with you. At what point when were the first comics for grown-ups? When did those first show up?
Depends on how you define it. But if you mean the underground comics from the late 60s, they were the ones first produced by artists for a pure audience. Prior to that, there were comics I would regard as eligible for adults, but they were not perceived that way. I mean, for example, I mentioned Uncle Scrooge or Mad Comics by Harvey Kurtzman. They were perceived as kids' comics, but when we look back, I mean, they were very adult, very sophisticated. It's just the industry in those days did not realize there was a potential adult audience. And if you were an adult back in the 50s or 60s reading comics, you were regarded as a, how should we put it kindly, a slow adult.
Well, in hindsight, it's easy to see the brilliance of your discovery that comics would work for adults as well as for kids. But at what point did you begin to realize that there was a great adult market for comics?
I think when I was in college, I was discovering the new kind of Marvel revolution. Stan Lee began creating Spider-Man and Fantastic Four, among others. And when they began, they were completely different than any other kind of super comics that had been in the market before. These were superheroes who were neurotic and had problems and fought with each other. And prior to that, you have to remember the early Batman, Superman, and other superheroes, they were very two-dimensional, really goody-two-shoes characters. The villains were also very two-dimensional. There were no shades of gray. And what Stan brought was a certain sophistication and a completely young approach to these kinds of heroes. And they were completely refreshing to my generation.
Well, looking back over your life history, it sort of seems as though comics just never really let you go. So you just kind of continued with them. What was the first one you published and really sold? Was it Mom's Underground Comics?
Yeah, it was the self-published one I did myself because I didn't know how to approach a publisher. I didn't know that any publisher would realistically be interested in my work. And thus I had to basically on a larger scale do what I had done in grade school and high school, which is manufacture and distribute and market and be the collection agent and everything.
And this was the late 60s, so who was buying Mom's Underground Comics?
Well, this was the beginning of the hippie generation, and so it was mostly to college students, and anyone with long hair was presumed to be a potential customer. So I went to every head shop and used bookstore and music store and basically put the comics in on consignment, and then we'd go back a week or two later, see if they'd sold, and would replace them, collect the money. And to my astonishment, they were flying off the shelves. This was the summer of 69. I printed 4,000 copies, and I sold virtually all of them in my general neighborhood on the east side of Milwaukee.
Wow, summer of 69. That was the height of the student anti-war movement. Was that mostly what your comic material was?
To some degree, it was, yes. It was political. It was cultural satire. It was stuff about drugs, tentative things about sex, every taboo subject that you wouldn't have seen in a comic prior to that, suddenly I and my peers thought we had the opportunity to comment on. It was kind of a period of liberation in general, and so comics that had always been perceived as being juvenile, suddenly we realized this is a medium, and it's no different than radio or TV or film or literature. You just have to remember that the counterculture, by definition, didn't trust anything that came out of the mass media. And so underground newspapers and underground comics were effectively the literature of that generation at that point in time.
So let's fast forward to the 80s. How did the scene change?
Obviously, the hippie movement didn't last forever. And in short terms, most of us ended up getting regular jobs and cutting our hair. And the comics that we were putting out began to be more difficult to distribute because those head shops we were counting on had their own problems, mostly legal problems, restrictions on selling smoking paraphernalia and so forth. And so we found ourselves, certainly in the mid-70s and late 70s, finding it tougher to get into the marketplace. But at the same time, the comic book industry itself was evolving in a way that made comic books no longer something distributed on newsstands, but distributed through specialty shops that we now would just generically call comic book shops. And where there had been virtually none of those when I was starting, there became hundreds and then thousands of them. And so basically what I did was I shifted my focus into what would less likely be called underground comics and became specialty comics and graphic novels. I began reprinting some of the classic comics, like Will Eisner's Spirit and Harvey Kurtzman's comics and Little Abner and Flash Gordon and that sort of thing. At the same time, I was encouraging young cartoonists who I thought were really good, but underground comic became kind of a misnomer at that point, and they became known generally as alternative comics or any term that would distinguish them from still the mainstream superheroes.
And so who were the stars of this second generation?
Some of the artists continued to be stars. Somebody like Robert Crumb has never really faded. He's only gotten bigger and bigger with time, and certainly someone like Art Spiegelman, who went on to create Mouse, and there were a number of them. But I took my greatest pleasure, I think, in getting somebody like Will Eisner, who was a previous generation artist, to basically get back into the industry. He discovered underground comics, became inspired by them, and he's the guy who basically created the graphic novel genre.
A lot of people attribute the start of graphic novels to Eisner, but those first graphic novels that he did them with you. So really we owe graphic novels to you, don't we?
Well, technically, the first one he did was with a small company he invested in that went out of business very quickly, and then I inherited it. And then I ended up doing the next 18 or so of his graphic novels. So, yeah, we had a close relationship. It was great, even though superficially it wouldn't have looked like we had much in common when we met. He was balding and had a three-piece suit and was about 25 years older than me, and I was long hair with, kind of classic hippie boots and probably tie-dyed pants. And as Will Eisner once put it, we both smoked pipes, but with different substances. And And yet what we had in common was not only a love of the medium, but a belief that the potential of the medium had really not been fully developed.
Thinking about all the different ways this comics business has changed, does it mean something different today to be a comic or graphic novelist than it did, 20, 30 years ago?
Absolutely. I would say today, people who are working in this field now are proud to say they create graphic novels. The generation of Will Eisner and Harvey Kurtzman, I can tell you from their own comments, back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, when they would be at a cocktail party and someone would say, "What do you do for a living?" If they said they were in the comic book industry, people would take their drink and walk away. It was not a respected profession. When I began going to college, and I wasn't sure what I was going to major in, and I thought, well, I should take some art classes if I want to be a cartoonist, but I quickly found out that the hostility to comics was intense. All of that has changed so that now it's, for better or worse, a more respectable profession, but it didn't come easily, it didn't come overnight.
Well, Dennis, in addition to publishing the works of countless illustrators over the last several decades, you also published audio projects with a lot of them. We heard that old 78 RPM a little bit earlier. Is there anything else you brought for us to listen to?
The other thing I brought is a picture disc that I published back in, I think, the 80s, and it's a song that Will Eisner wrote in the late 40s called Every Little Bug. And I don't think it was recorded at the time, but we had the sheet music, and so we got some contemporary musicians to record variants of it. And then it alternates, though, with dialogue from a late 40s spirit TV show. So that's a very dramatic, almost kind of a radio dialogue.
Later, at Wildwood Cemetery, secret headquarters of the spirit. Okay, Ebony, here, go buy yourself all the sodas you want, only stop that creaking.
Be with us again tomorrow, same time, same television station, for the next thrilling chapter in The Adventures of the Spirit. The Adventures of the Spirit appears in leading comic magazines from coast to coast.
The firefly don't have to cry. He knows from the glow that it's his gal gone by. Oh, every little bug has a honey to hug but me. And even Noah, when building his ark, would never keep one lonely lark or refuse.
Dennis Kitchen is an illustrator and publisher who founded Kitchen Sink Press in 1969. Today, he operates Kitchen Lind & Associates, a literary agency for graphic novelists. His new book is called The Oddly Compelling Art of Dennis Kitchen. He spoke with N. Strange Champs.